Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by Sylvan Learning Centers, dedicated to helping students gain confidence and self-esteem by reaching their full academic potential. 1-800-EDUCATE.
Good morning. Welcome to Mid-Morning. I'm Mike Mulcahy, sitting in today for Catherine Lanfer. Well, Minnesota is facing an energy shortage. The experts say the upper Midwest will need the equivalent of 5 new nuclear power plants by the end of this decade to meet increasing demand for power, and that Minnesota will account for about half of that demand. Part of the problem, of course, is that no one is building nuclear power plants anymore in the U.S. Coal-fired plants most likely contribute to global warming, and suddenly natural gas is more expensive than it's ever been. A poll conducted for Minnesota Public Radio and the St. Paul Pioneer Press shows that Minnesotans are concerned about the power shortage, but as a first step toward addressing it, most people, 2 out of 3 people, want to look at alternative energy sources like wind and water rather than building new conventional power plants. We thought we'd spend this hour looking at just how practical alternatives like wind power really are. Will they be a major part of the solution to Minnesota's energy demands? What do you think? And how much are you willing to pay for look for alternative ways to power the way you live? You can join our conversation by calling 651-227-6000 in the Twin Cities, 651-227-6000. Anywhere else you're listening today, it's a toll-free call, 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. Our guest today is a member of a new coalition called the Power, which is promoting alternatives, efficiency, and more regulation as a way to approach this coming energy shortage. Bill Grant is a member of that coalition. As I say, he directs the Midwest office of the Isaac Walton League. Thanks for being here today, Bill Grant.
Thank you, Mike.
Now, your group is calling for Minnesota to get 10% of its energy from wind power by the end of the decade, right?
Well, Mike, we're calling for wind to play a significant part of meeting our growing energy needs. We expect other renewables, other new technologies to make up a fair part of that as well. Things like biomass power are very practical in Minnesota, a little bit more expensive right now than wind. But
and now biomass is basically
plant matter in the form of waste from crops or waste from animal agriculture. Trees certainly make up a fair share of that.
So basically anything you grow and then you can convert into energy.
That's right.
Okay. Is it practical to do this?
We think so. If you look at wind power, the potential in Minnesota is some 35,000 megawatts. Of course, we don't ever expect that we'll get that many megawatts online. But right now, we've got only about 300 megawatts online, and primarily in southwestern Minnesota, where the wind resource is so good.
And can you break down exactly what a megawatt means? I mean, how many houses would that?
A megawatt is enough power to serve roughly 1,000 homes.
Okay.
So if we get 10% of our power from wind, that's something on the order of 3,000 megawatts, and we feel that's very reasonable. People say, of course, that the wind doesn't blow all the time. Of course, that's true, but a large interconnected system like the one that is present here in the upper Midwest and throughout the United States can certainly allow us a fair percentage, maybe up to 20% of the power to come from intermittent sources like wind. And with biomass and other sources that are more base load in nature, we feel that renewables can play a very significant part of our energy future.
And how would the cost compare? Can you manufacture power using windmills as cheaply as it is to burn natural gas or burn coal?
Right now, the projections are that wind over the next 30 years will actually be cheaper than the other sources, primarily because, of course, wind doesn't require a fuel source. Unlike natural gas or coal, natural gas prices, as you know, are through the roof right now. They're expected to come back down again somewhat, but probably never return to the levels that we've enjoyed for the last 10 years or so. Coal is problematic only because we expect continuing evidence to show that coal-fired power plants produce pollutants that are going to need to be more and more strictly regulated. That will drive up the cost of coal.
And now, again, we talked a little bit about how much wind might actually be out there, but is there enough to do this? I mean, talk a little bit about how you get this power out of the wind and transmit it to people's homes?
Sure. Well, modern wind turbines are capable of producing high-quality power just like a new natural gas turbine or a new coal-fired power plant. That power then, of course, runs over high-voltage transmission lines to customers who need the power. We do have a transmission issue in southwestern Minnesota, but wind is very much like any power source in that you have to build the power lines to get the power to the market, and we expect that that's going to be the case with whatever we build.
Could that turn out to be more controversial than some of the other elements of this plan? I mean, I remember in Stearns County 25 years ago, it was a huge issue.
Well, it will be an issue, and local landowners are not going to be happy about having to accept new power facilities, new power lines. We believe that there are opportunities in southwestern Minnesota in particular to strengthen the existing transmission system by upgrading existing lines rather than having to build brand new lines that would require new routes over new property. And we think that that'll make those projects less controversial.
We're talking today on Mid-Morning with Bill Grant. He is the director of the Midwest Office of the Isaac Walton League of America. That's a conservation organization. He's also joined with a number of other groups in a coalition to try to chart out the way Minnesota will address this power shortage over the next decade. It's a different approach than other groups are taking, say the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and some others. And it relies on such things as alternative energy, regulation, and efficiency as a way to address the coming power shortage. We want you to join our conversation, too. In the Twin Cities, the number to call, 651-227-6000. Anywhere else, it's a toll-free call, 1-800-242-2828. And we have a number of people on the line already, so let's take a call. Heidi is calling from Minneapolis. Heidi, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi there.
Go ahead.
The comment that I wanted to make this morning was that I really think it's great that Minnesota is being proactive about this, and I would love to see more wind power, and I would definitely be willing to pay more for it. The other option I think that would be neat to explore would be solar.
Okay, let's talk about solar power a little bit. Is solar power as practical an alternative in Minnesota as wind might be?
Well, Mike, in remote locations, we already have a number of installations providing solar electricity to customers, particularly in cases where the distance from a power line would be too long to run a new line into that customer. And so we're seeing a number of those applications. I know the Department of Natural Resources is using solar power in a number of the state parks where running power lines in would be unacceptable for visitors. In terms of the kind of large-scale photovoltaic arrays that we see, say, in Arizona or Southern California, we don't expect those to be in Minnesota soon, although if prices continue to fall for those kinds of systems, who knows? But we don't think those are as near-term for large-scale power generation as, say, wind or biomass or some of the other sources.
Just because it's not as sunny here and the days are shorter?
It's not as sunny, days are shorter. We don't have the same solar incidence that, say, a Southern California does. That's right.
And why is it that wind is such an interesting option or such a viable option here?
Well, again, Minnesota and particularly North and South Dakota as well have been referred to as the Saudi Arabia of wind power. We really do enjoy a tremendously rich potential here to generate cheap energy from the wind. And again, we think we've only scratched the surface of that development potential.
It's a clean technology in that it doesn't there are no emissions when you get wind. But some people say that the generators themselves or the windmills kind of pollute the landscape, and that there are issues with birds flying into these things. Is that a major concern?
Well, in terms of the pollution of the landscape, I think that's the beauty in the eye of the beholder. Certainly, those farmers in southwestern Minnesota whose land these turbines are on, and for whom wind power has become a cash crop and really outstripping the value of land for them for row crops, These turbines are
they
quite beautiful.
Good.
They look pretty good. This area in southwestern Minnesota that we're referring to, the Buffalo Ridge, is a rather remote rural area. I think the residents there, given the property tax enhancements that have come with this development, millions of dollars in development that otherwise would not have occurred there, they've really warmed up to wind power in a big way. As far as the bird issue, we really haven't seen that here. Certainly, if you were to build wind turbines on major migratory flyways, it would perhaps be more problematic. Fortunately, the windy areas turn out not to be the flyway areas, and we just haven't seen those problems here.
Okay, and a megawatt is enough to power about 1,000 homes.
About 1,000 homes.
How many megawatts are coming out of the Buffalo Ridge right now?
About 300 to 400 megawatts, and when the current requirements on XL Energy are completed, we'll have roughly 800 megawatts. Again, what we're calling for with our power legislation is a much larger contribution coming from wind, say as much as 2,500 megawatts by the end of the decade.
2,500 megawatts. And where does that power go now? Is it staying in Minnesota, or is it probably hard to measure that?
It's a little hard to measure that because electrons tend to flow,
right,
much like water does, to the point of least resistance. We expect, though, since the Twin Cities is the largest close load area, followed, I guess, probably by the Sioux Falls area, wind power is either going here to the Twin Cities or to the Sioux Falls area primarily.
And is there, you know, with the everything we read every day in the paper about California, you know, needing power, if we have the Saudi Arabia of wind in the upper Midwest here, and we start generating a bunch of wind power, what's to stop that energy from flowing right to the West Coast instead of to here in Minnesota where we need it?
Well, Mike, the way this, it's a little complex, but the way the system works, there are control areas for generation within a particular geographic region. The generation in that region tends to stay within that region unless it's contractually shipped elsewhere. And the difficulty shipping power to the West Coast from here is that the interconnection over the Rocky Mountains is actually fairly weak. Most of the power used in California is generated somewhere on the West Coast.
I see. So it's just it's a question of getting it from here to there.
That's right.
Through power lines,
that's
obviously.
Right.
All right, let's take another call. We have John calling from Minneapolis. John, go ahead, please.
Hello. First of all, you just briefly mentioned conservation, and would the speaker agree that conservation is the most efficient and cost-effective way first to deal with power? And then my second question is, I've heard that North Dakota has enough power to wind power potential to serve the entire country, and these are obviously kind of regional issues. With the transmission problem from that, could some of the new fuel cell technologies be used for transporting some of that power?
Excellent questions, John. They were both on my list. Which one do you want to start with?
Let's start with conservation, or as we prefer to refer to it, energy efficiency. And your caller is right. Energy conservation is easily the cheapest energy resource available to us. Our prediction is that, or our assessment is that, over the last decade, Minnesota has saved roughly 2,000 megawatts through various energy efficiency programs that utilities have sponsored on behalf of their customers. That's roughly the equivalent of two large nuclear power plants. And we think that there's an equal amount of potential going forward into the next decade. And that's clearly the thing that we ought to be doing first and foremost, is really capturing the efficiency potential.
You know, when we did this poll, though, with the Pioneer Press this morning, and you can find the poll on our website, minnesotapublicradio.org, and in today's Pioneer Press, and also check out a page on our website called This Cold House, where we're dealing with some energy issues. The question we asked was, which of the following actions should the state take first to begin dealing with any potential shortage? And one of them was the alternative energy question, which 2 out of 3 people said, yeah, let's go that way. Another was encourage substantial conservation efforts, even if that involved paying more for electricity. And only 9% of the people said they wanted to do that.
Well, and Mike, I think the question was unfortunately worded because it tended to single out conservation as
more expensive,
a potentially more expensive resource. And actually, it's probably the cheapest resource available to us. I think had the question been asked without that caveat, you would have seen a much higher response rate. The fact is that anything we build, and since we're in a mode now where we're going to need to add new power resources to serve Minnesotans, our rates are going to be going up, and there's just no getting around that. New coal-fired power plants will have a significant impact on rates, as will new natural gas, almost anything we add. And in fact, the way to really hold down those rates is through conservation. So I feel like the question was somewhat
a little unfair
to conservation.
But you know, when you go to the hardware store and you need to buy new light bulbs and you buy an incandescent, it's, you know, you get four for $2, and when you look at one of those compact fluorescents, it's a $12 expense.
And that is difficult. And what customers, of course, need to do is remember that the incandescent bulb will last about 3 to 6 months, whereas the compact fluorescent will last up to 5 years. And during that five-year period, the compact fluorescent will use a third as much energy to generate the same amount of light output. So the savings are really tremendous, even though the upfront costs are quite a bit higher. That's why utility programs and others' incentives to bring down those first costs are so effective in transforming the market for energy efficiency.
And you say we've saved 2,000 megawatts in conservation. With demand growing as it is, how much can conservation play a role from your point of view in meeting this coming shortage?
Our estimate is that over the next decade, there's another 1,500 megawatts of efficiency potential easily capturable by the level of investment that we're proposing in our legislation.
And that's 1.5 Prairie Island nuclear
plants. That's 1.5 Prairie Island nuclear plants. That's right.
All righty. Let's take another call. Patrick is calling from Sauk Center. Patrick, go ahead. You're on Mid-Morning.
Yes, good morning. Say, would you folks speak to biomass, in particular methane digesters from agriculture areas, from cattle, turkey waste, if possibly interconnected with wind to help heat the digesters? And then also, would you speak to the potential for positive aspects of having many small cogenerators versus these huge power plants that would be so easily taken out by a terrorist? And I'll hang up and take. But again, biomass, turkey, cattle, the manure thing, potential there.
Okay.
And then the risk of huge power plants to terrorists.
Well, once again, our callers know much more about the subject than our hosts, certainly. Methane digesters, what are those?
Methane digesters take animal waste, convert that animal waste through a process breaking down the animal waste into gas that can be burned in a power plant. And there are a number of experiments going forward now with that technology. We expect that those experiments are going to prove the technology and begin bringing down the cost of those digesters. Those typically are the kinds of energy systems that are most useful locally. In other words, they produce about enough energy for a farm's energy use, with maybe a little bit to sell back to the grid. It's, again, not going to be the large central station power plants that provide a lot of energy. But as your caller suggests, we think that the wave of the future is in smaller distributed technologies like the cogeneration applications that he's mentioned that can really bring power resources closer to the customer, avoid the need for large transmission lines, and as your caller also suggests, avoid possible terrorism against large power plants, although we've not seen that, and I don't really count that as a major risk.
But when you're talking about cogeneration, you mean basically there's one thing happening, say a farm or another industry, and at the same time they're using some of their byproducts to create their own energy.
Cogeneration is a process whereby waste heat from an industrial process, for example, is plowed back into a turbine to generate electricity. It can be done at a power plant as well. About at a typical large coal-fired power plant, about two-thirds of the energy in the coal is wasted as heat up the power plant stack. If that heat is recaptured and used to turn a secondary turbine, the power plant can become much more efficient, using as much as half or more of the useful energy in the fuel to generate electricity.
Now, what has been your experience, and we will have certainly other people on talking about this issue over the next few months, but What has been your experience in taking some of these ideas to XL Energy, for example? Are they fairly receptive to some of these ideas?
Well, I think XL, to their credit, has really been one of the leaders nationally in the utility industry in demonstrating new technologies. Some of that, of course, has been through mandates, which they may have otherwise preferred not to have on them. Once the mandates were in place, the company has really taken developing these technologies quite seriously. I think without their involvement in the wind power projects in southwestern Minnesota, we wouldn't see the kind of development that's taking place down there today.
And back to a point the caller made, and you were talking about sort of a decentralized power outlook or scenario. How practical is that? Will we see, instead of huge power plants in one place, or maybe along with huge power plants in one central location, everybody generating sort of in their own little towns?
I think that more and more will become the trend for several reasons. One, for the benefits, the efficiency and pollution benefits that come with smaller, more efficient power plants, but also that utilities and investors in utilities are becoming increasingly wary of making the huge capital investment that it takes to build large central station power plants. If we were to build, say, another 800 or 1,000 megawatt coal plant tomorrow, by the way, they take about 8 to 10 years to come online, so they're very bulky that way. But even if we were to do that, and let's say that our economic situation didn't continue to grow the way it has been over the last decade, investors could find themselves holding on to an investment that just wasn't paying off for them. And we think increasingly Wall Street investors are going to be leery of the large central station generating plants of the past.
All righty. We're talking with Bill Grant. He is the director of the Midwest office of the Isaac Walton League. We're talking about alternative energy. Let's see if we can get one more phone call on here before the news. Let's go to Joy in Cannon Falls. Hello, Joy.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. I live in rural southeastern Minnesota on a little 20-acre farm, and my husband and I have been exploring the idea of wind generation and also heating our house through a newer, you know, more efficient wood-burning stove application or fireplace. And I've been exploring the internet and finding a lot of good information, and I've talked to my local rural co-op, and they have been very helpful as well. But I guess I'm looking for some help in this, because the cost of putting up a windmill are about $20,000 to $25,000, as far as I can tell, and putting in a fireplace or a wood burning stove to help heat the house is probably another $4,000 or $5,000. And I'm just wondering, is there any sort of program that helps homeowners do these kind of energy efficiencies that I might be able to tap into?
Okay, good question, Joy. This is more on the sort of the micro level rather than the macro level.
That's right. And Joy, the first thing I would have you do is write to us for a copy of our publication, The Landowner's Guide to Wind Energy, because I think it'll help you identify what the steps are that you need to go through. You need to, first of all, put an anemometer on your property for probably a year to really test the wind speed there and determine whether or not it's going to be cost effective for you to make that investment or not.
So check in with the Isaac Walton League first, and you've got some information.
We have a publication that I think she'll find quite useful.
Okay, well, maybe we'll talk a little more about this after the break. We'll certainly take more calls after we take a short break. We're talking again with Bill Grant about alternative energy and what role it might play in Minnesota's energy future. We invite your calls and questions as well. Let's stop for a brief minute here, though, and check in with the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. Greta Cunningham standing by.
Thanks, Mike, and good morning. Big record companies are hoping a court will force computer users to start paying for the songs Napster lets them download for free. A federal court will decide today whether to uphold an injunction ordering the online music swapping service to shut down, pending a trial. NASA scientists are trying to bring a space probe and an asteroid together in deep space today. The craft has been circling the asteroid for about a year and is about to run out of fuel. Instead of just letting it go, NASA will try to bring it down intact on the surface. The Coast Guard now says it's possible that 9 people may have gone down with their fishing boat after it was struck by a U.S. submarine last Friday, but the search for the missing will continue through the afternoon off the Hawaiian coast. President Bush will announce he's seeking more than $2 billion from Congress to raise military pay and living standards and to provide incentives to keep skilled people in the armed forces. Bush is visiting Fort Stewart, Georgia today. U.S. House Speaker Dennis Hastert is recovering this morning from kidney stone surgery. The Illinois Republican admitted himself to a Chicago-area hospital last night after experiencing abdominal pain for several days. Doctors expect him to make a full recovery. In regional news, Minnesotan Anne Bancroft and Norwegian Liv Arneson are the first women to ski across the Antarctic landmass, but they still have a long way to go. The duo must still ski across nearly 500 miles of frozen ocean before they reach the ship that will take them home. A continuous parking ban is on for Minneapolis streets after last week's heavy snowfall. The ban on the even side of most residential streets will remain in effect until April 1st, unless enough snow melts for city officials to lift it. The forecast for Minnesota today calls for a few flurries or snow showers this morning in eastern Minnesota. Continued cloudy skies in the north with partial clearing in the south. Highs today mostly in the 20s. Checking current conditions around the region, St. Cloud reports some light snow, a temperature of 16. Mist in Rochester in 25 degrees. Light snow in Duluth in 16 degrees. And in the Twin Cities, some freezing drizzle continues to fall with a temperature of 22 degrees. That's a look at the latest news.
Thank you, Greta. Programs on Minnesota Public Radio are paid for by the annual support of listeners like you. If you've received a membership notice in the mail, please remember to mail it in right away. And thanks. And Minnesota Public Radio is looking for enthusiastic volunteers to answer phones during our next membership drive. The drive dates are February 23rd through March 2nd. If you want to volunteer, 1-800-228-7123 or sign up online at minnesotapublicradio.org. And again, thank you. Well, coming up at 10 o'clock today, we're going to be talking about the charter school experiment in Minnesota. Charter schools have been around for 10 years now, and just in the past few days, we've had calls from at least one state legislator saying that charter schools need more supervision by the state, especially to look at some of their financial management. That's coming up in our 10 o'clock hour. Right now, we're talking with Bill Grant. He is the regional director of the Isaac Walton League. We're talking about alternative energy as Minnesota looks into a decade where we will need the equivalent of 2 or 3 new major nuclear power plants. The Isaac Walton League and others say that we should look at alternative energy and conservation and regulation first before we start building some power plants. And we do welcome your calls and questions. 651-227-6000 is the number to call in the Twin Cities. 651-227-6000. Anywhere else you're listening, it's a toll-free call, 1-800-242-2800. And Bill Grant, right before we took a break there, we had a call from a listener who was thinking about doing this at her own home, at her own farmstead. Is it practical for people to do that?
Well, it is, Mike, particularly in areas with decent wind resources. And again, as I was mentioning before the break, I think it would be a good idea for anyone who's considering this because, as the caller mentioned, the upfront cost is significant to really test whether or not the wind speed and the steady wind speed over the course of the year is such that it would really make it practical for them to pursue that option. There are other renewable energy options available to people where wind energy is not the best option, and I would encourage all your listeners to be open to other possibilities.
Okay, let's take another call. John is on the line from Minneapolis. John, hello.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I have a couple of comments and a question. My first comment, I just wanted to know how practical it is to utilize like solar energy panels and wind power and you know, in your home right now, because there are many companies that do sell these panels, and I don't know that they can provide all your energy needs, but they certainly can reduce your energy bill. Of course, the initial investment is kind of high, although the prices on a lot of those materials have gone down. And then the second comment I wanted to make is that, which kind of leads into my third comment, is that there already is a lot of very simple technology to build passive solar homes. And passive solar homes will work here as well as in the Southwest or in more sunny or in more arid regions of the country, like in the Western United States. They may not provide all the the heating you need, but
just speed it up a little bit, John.
Okay, and then my third comment is about let's see, up to 1983, I know this for a fact because I had a house that had solar equipment. This was in the Southwest, but you got four skylights, and then for I think more insulation, and also solar. Active and passive solar designs, you got a rebate from the federal government, and many states match that. And that was up until the first, up to 1983, and then they took that direct rebate away. So that was, in other words, you got, you know, a direct rebate. You didn't get a percentage. You got just whatever amount off. That I think it was up to a certain amount, but it did help considerably. And I think it would be a good idea for them to restart that program, or at least consider it with, you know, at the federal and state levels.
Okay, you've given us a lot to chew on here. We'll talk about it quickly. Energy breaks, energy tax credits.
Right, and as your caller mentioned, we had tax credits in place in response to the late 70s, early 80s energy crises. The difficulty with tax credits is that unless you're intending to leave them in place for a long period of time and let consumers know when they're likely to sunset, they can actually be more disruptive to the market in some ways than they can be helpful. We had a lot of companies that started up in response to the tax credits and then immediately go under when the tax credits were removed in the late 80s. That kind of boom and bust cycle isn't very good for the industry, and probably not that good for consumers either, because once the companies go away, then the companies aren't there to service the equipment that has been installed in customers' homes.
And it does seem as if a lot of this technology has gotten much better or much more efficient over just the past few years.
That's right, and a lot of new companies in Minnesota are doing business now without tax credits, and we expect them to be in business over the long haul. The kinds of things that the caller mentioned, using solar for hot water in your home is a good idea. I don't know for electricity generation on that small a scale, again, without the kind of solar incidents that they enjoy in southwestern part of the United States. Passive solar is always a good idea. You should leave your south-facing windows open in your house during the winter, because it can really lower your heating costs.
At least leave the curtains off.
At least leave the curtains. I'm sorry.
Not open. that wouldn't help.
That would not help. You're right. Leave the curtains open. Exactly.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones. We've got a lot of callers on the line. Rich is calling from Oakdale. Hello, Rich.
Hi. The reason I'm calling today is I know you're talking about basically electrical energy and having that capacity available.
Mm-hmm.
And on the hottest day of the summer, when we hit our summer peak, that's typically the dog days of summer when we don't have any wind. So if you look at the catastrophe that happened down in Chicago a few years ago, where it got really hot and they had rolling blackouts and elderly people died in their apartments and stuff like that, if we build a system based on using wind power, we're basically setting ourselves up for the type of catastrophe that they had in Chicago.
Good question, Rich. What about that?
Well, your caller is right that wind patterns in Minnesota tend to have our lowest wind power output available to us during the hottest months. That's why, as I've said before, wind is only a part of the answer that we're seeking here. Wind power, though, can play a much larger role than it has. We're not talking about making ourselves dependent exclusively on wind power, and I don't think any reasonable person would suggest that. One of the exciting things that we're seeing going on in the industry right now is that developers are coupling wind projects to natural gas-fired peaking plants so that the natural gas plant can follow the wind turbine, so that when the wind isn't blowing, the turbine can ramp up to provide the energy that would otherwise be coming from the wind turbine. that makes a very nice marriage and one that we think is going to represent a real step forward in the ability of wind to provide an increasing share of our energy needs.
And would that work on, say, the hottest days in August when everybody has their air conditioner on?
It would, absolutely. In fact, natural gas is usually cheapest during the summer because natural gas peaks during the winter in this part of the country when everyone's using
heating.
It for heating.
Right.
Exactly.
Hmm. And they are actually now building the wind turbines right next to a natural gas?
They don't need to be physically located next to, but they need to be dedicated at the controller's discretion so that, when the wind isn't blowing, the natural gas can be ramped up to provide that energy.
All right. And when we say that your power coalition plan is calling for a certain amount of these energy alternatives to meet the state's needs, how much are we talking about?
Well, we think that it's possible with the technologies that we've outlined, including energy efficiency, all the renewable energy sources that we've spoken of this morning, the advanced technologies, fuel cells, cogeneration applications, district heating systems, that we can meet the 2,500 to 3,000 megawatt need with those sources alone and thus avoid the need for new large coal or nuclear plants. We're not saying, though, that we'll never need to build another one of those kinds of facilities. We're saying these are the kinds of things that can happen right away. They usually take anywhere from 9 to 18 months to site and build, as opposed to a large coal or nuclear plant, which can take many years to site and build. These are things we can get started with right away. They're not controversial because, as your poll suggests, people really support these kinds of projects and will support them when they're proposed in their local areas.
All righty, let's take another phone call. Ralph is calling from St. Paul. Ralph, go ahead, please.
Hello.
Hi.
Okay, I guess you got me here. I had one comment that struck me. Nobody's mentioned it so far. It's a little statistic I heard when I was interested in alternative power many years ago, and it's always stayed with me. The statistic goes like this. If we had spent the money on solar energy beginning as of the end of World War II that we had spent on nuclear power up to about 1980, right now this country would be 100% energy self-sufficient. I've not heard this coming from the Energy Coalition here, and I wonder if maybe this fact could be made a little bit more present.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thanks for the call.
Well, certainly your caller is right that the amount of money that the federal government has put into research and support for conventional technologies, particularly nuclear power, absolutely overwhelms the amount of money that we've put into alternatives like solar power. I don't know about the statistic that he cites, whether or not we would be energy self-sufficient by now. I know we'd be a lot closer to it than we are today.
It doesn't sound as if you are really asking, though, the government to spend a lot of money on this plan.
We're not. In fact, our plan calls for no general fund appropriations. The only real money in the bill is to create a surcharge on customers' bills to replace the money that's already in their rate structures for energy efficiency programs. And so we're really calling for very little new money from consumers to implement the plan.
And you are also talking about more regulation of power plants, right? And that's sort of running up against the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, which is calling for, they don't want to use the word deregulation after what happened in California, but certainly less regulation.
Well, there are two kinds of regulation, I think, at issue here. One is the kind of rate regulation that's been in place in Minnesota and most other states for 60 or 70 years. The chamber would have us eliminate that rate regulation and allow customers to choose their own power supplier. We think that's a bad idea, particularly at a time when the state is facing an energy shortage. The kind of regulation, though, that we call for in the bill is pollution regulation on the existing older coal-fired power plants. Right now, those plants provide about 75% of our state's electricity. These plants' average age is about 50 years. This is very old, outdated technology. We think that it needs to be brought up and modernized, brought up to date, and that's the form of regulation that we're calling for in the bill.
We're talking with Bill Grant today. He is the director of the Midwest Office of the Isaac Walton League. That's a conservation organization working with a number of other organizations up at the Capitol this legislative session to try to have an influence on what's going to happen with our energy shortage in Minnesota. A number of other groups working as well, and I believe the bills get their first hearing today in the House Committee, is it?
That's right, in the House Regulated Industries Committee this afternoon. All three of the bills, our bill, which is, again, a coalition bill from consumers, senior citizens, low-income advocates, laborers at the power plants and the transmission lines, and then environmental groups statewide. The other two bills being brought forward by the Chamber of Commerce, as you've mentioned, and the Minnesota Department of Commerce.
Right. Okay, let's take another call. William is calling from Pinewood. William?
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
Yeah, I was curious why we can't, as individuals, and also encourage our government agencies to reward conservation. One of the things is our rate structures. It seems backwards to me that the more energy that we consume, the rate goes down. I would think that you could have a lower rate, say, for the first 500 kilowatts, and then gradually increase from there to reward conservation. And also the government could reward people for building human-scale houses rather than these monstrosities we see, 5,000 square foot houses for two people.
Okay. What about that? Does the current rate structure work, or should it be changed?
Well, we've said for a number of years that the kind of declining block rate structure, in other words, where the rates go down the more you use, certainly is a disincentive to conservation. That's just one of many ways in which conservation is really at a disadvantage in the current rate structure. Another example is that as companies add investment to their rate base, that's those are the dollars on which they earn their rate of return. And typically, unselling their product like conservation programs ask them to do is really counter to their own self-interest, and which is why the Department of Commerce and others have suggested that these programs be taken away from the utilities and run either by the state or by local contractors, as we suggest, as a way of removing that particular disincentive.
And I don't want to get into the whole thing about how many square feet your house should be. That's another program. But what about the building code in Minnesota for new homes? Is it in fairly good shape now?
Well, the building code, the building energy code in Minnesota, is probably one of the best in the country. The difficulty with the code is enforcement, and the state really does not have the resources, or has not applied the resources toward training building code regulators or enforcement agents to, particularly in greater Minnesota, to make sure that the code is being enforced. And we're really missing an opportunity there, because if we were building buildings to the code, clearly we would be leagues ahead of where we are now in terms of our conservation efforts.
All righty. Let's take another phone call. David is calling from Minneapolis. David, you with us? David? I think his phone might have run out of energy there. Kind of what it sounded like. Let me try him again. David, can you hear us?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Sorry about that.
Okay, I just heard a hiss, but
yeah,
yes.
Me too.
I've got a small list of things. Fiber optic lighting for bringing the indoor light, or outdoor light rather, in. They're kind of spendy, but, you know, eliminates electric lights for both homes and companies, you know, for obviously it only works during the day. I put in a corn heater. Corn is way cheaper than gas. It doesn't have the BTU content quite, but it's cheaper. It's renewable. It doesn't really add to the thermal pollution because it's a renewable, and you know, as against coal, that's stored energy. And I don't know about maybe corn-fired air conditioners like gas air conditioning. I'm not sure if some alternative heating other than gas would work with air conditioning. Composting toilets that, you know, you're not flushing that waste down the drain, which has to spend electricity or spend power at the waste treatment plant. I mean, if new homes are required to have composting toilets, they have to be maintained. You got to babysit the things to a certain degree, not excessively, and I think they'd save energy in the long run. And one final thing, there's a lot of other alternative energy things that aren't being talked about, like wave power, ocean current power, which isn't appropriate for Minnesota, but it is for coastal areas, and then big thermal chimneys for the desert, where you're bringing water up from the coast and pumping them in, and then the sun in the desert just causes an updraft, which then causes the humid air to rise up and turn big turbines. I mean, nobody ever hears about these other things, especially the wave power and the ocean current power.
Well, you are way ahead of the curve here, David. I did see a story in the paper, actually, about a couple of weeks ago about some wave current machine that they built in Scotland, I think.
Yeah, your caller really is on the cutting edge of the of the energy field here. And some of these things, frankly, I'm not that familiar with either. I know that there have been some experiments internationally with wave power. whether they are going to prove to be a significant energy source or not, I just don't know. Certainly, I think there are some things we can get started with sooner than some of the more exotic technologies.
What about these power cells? Somebody mentioned them a little earlier. What exactly is a power cell, and how would that help in all this?
I think we referred to a fuel cell.
Fuel cell
is like a giant battery, essentially, which takes either natural gas or preferably in the future hydrogen as the fuel source, and through a chemical process, electrochemical process, converts the fuel into useful electricity. We think that there, in the next 5 to 10 years, that we're going to see more and more applications for fuel cells, and that as time goes on, they will start out in fairly large applications, say as backup power in hospitals or grocery stores, and then move into smaller and smaller applications until one day it will be an off-the-shelf technology available for home use.
So you could have one of these things in your basement.
Absolutely.
Or out in the backyard, and it could provide you electricity.
That's
right,
right
in the house.
That's right.
Well, let's hope we live to see that. Let's get another caller here. Mike is calling in from Lake Elmo. Mike, go ahead, please.
Oh, hi. Thanks for this great opportunity. I've lived in two really energy-efficient houses. One of them was an earth shelter that had a greenhouse out in front of it that would get up into the 90s during the middle of the winter if it was sunny, and early in the morning, too, about an hour or two after sunrise. And if we didn't use any heat at all in there, it would only get down to 50 all winter long. We actually did this as an experiment. It was cold. I wouldn't suggest it. And I now live in something called an envelope home that is built like a house within a house, and there's an envelope of air that is heated by windows on the south side, and it circulates over the living space, and it doesn't even have a furnace. And it's all electric heating, which we very rarely use except for in the bathrooms. And our total electric bill is like $60 a month.
Hmm. And it's been warm enough this winter?
Yes, actually. It has a wood stove, and we use the wood stove when we have to. And we burn about half or two-thirds of a cord of wood for a three-bedroom, three-bathroom house.
Wow. So, well, thanks for the call, Mike. Bill Grant, it sounds like there are some strides we could make. I mean, not every house is like this.
Not every house is like this, and not every consumer out there is going to be willing to put the kind of money up front into a home to make it this energy efficient. Although, again, it's like the calculation we did earlier on the compact fluorescent versus the incandescent light bulb. Taken over the life of the product, in this case, a 40, 50-year life of a home, these things can work out economically. It assumes, of course, that you're going to live in the house that long, and most people feel, I think, that they can't be that certain about their future life plans to make those kinds of investments. But for those that can, and we're seeing a fair number of people that are willing to make those kinds of commitments to live a more sustainable lifestyle, and I applaud that.
$60 a month would have looked pretty good to
absolutely
a lot of people this winter.
Absolutely, it would have. I don't know about your bill, but mine was close to $300 last month, and mine is a well-insulated home.
I don't even like to think about mine, quite frankly. Let's go back to the phone lines. James from Cohasset. James, go ahead, please.
Yes, I was just wondering. I talked to people who have been around these wind generator areas, and they say there's a lot of noise associated with the wind turbines.
Okay, that's a good question.
Some of the older wind turbines, and I think the caller may be referring to some of the technologies that came into California during the tax credit years in that state, mid-80s or so, some of the first technology was quite noisy. And the good news in Minnesota is that one of the siting requirements for wind turbines is to have a certain setback from residential homes. With a sufficient setback and the quieter modern technology, most people can't tell the difference between the wind blowing in their ears and the sound of the wind turbine at the setback distance or beyond, and so it really hasn't been an issue here.
What do you think is going to happen at the legislature this year as you bring these proposals forward?
Well, I expect that we're going to have a very rich discussion over the next couple of months about the state's energy future. The situation in California, the high natural gas prices, and the Department of Commerce's estimate about the shortage that we face here has all really focused legislators' attention on this energy issue. And I think that there's a consensus, at least, that we need to move forward this year proactively with legislation. What that's going to look like in the end is hard to say. I think it's going to be some combination, probably, of the three bills. But certainly we hope that the state will see the wisdom of moving more aggressively into the areas that we've outlined, efficiency, renewable energy, new technologies, while protecting consumers and workers.
Well, if you go to more efficiency, we've talked about some of the upfront costs, who should have to pay those?
Well, consumers will always be the ones who will pay in the end. Utilities pass costs on to their customers for all forms of energy that they generate and the cost of maintaining the system. We would expect that that's going to be the case going into the future. We happen to think that the technologies that we're promoting actually are the less expensive technologies over the long run than the large bulky investments in new coal, new nuclear, what have you, which will also, if built, flow into the rate structure.
And if this doesn't happen this year, if we have to wait till next year or the year beyond, where does that put Minnesota?
Well, I think it puts us more and more behind the eight ball. The longer we wait, the less diverse the mix of options becomes for meeting our future energy needs, the more likely it becomes that we have to make an emergency kind of a decision to build something large and something that, had we gotten started earlier with these smaller technologies and continued on a steady pace, would have easily accomplished the mission.
And how big is the fight going to be over this deregulation versus regulation?
Well, our sense is that deregulation is really off the table this year, and I know that that'll be bad news for the chamber and the large utilities who are really promoting it, but none of the legislators I've spoken to are in favor of deregulating this year, particularly, again, in light of what everyone agrees was a failed deregulation experiment in California.
And so it's just not going to happen.
Again, anything can and will happen at the legislature, Mike, but I really think the strong sense that I get is that deregulation this year is not part of the agenda.
And one more time, give me the figures now on what you think you can solve virtually this entire problem by conservation.
Again, a combination of a large chunk of energy efficiency, probably some 1,500 megawatts coming from energy efficiency, another several thousand, 2,000 to 3,000 megawatts coming from a combination of wind power, biomass power, other renewables, and the distributed technologies that we've spoken of, fuel cells and the more modern technologies. We think that combination, along with modernizing the existing power plants, and when we do so, because we're making them more efficient, they also provide more energy. That's the winning combination for Minnesota.
Well, thanks so much for being with us today. That's Bill Grant, the director of the Midwest Office of the Isaac Walton League, working on some of these energy issues at the state capitol.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by Potlatch, producing fine-coated paper and building products in Minnesota for more than a century.
Getting the news is one thing. Being informed is quite another.